The following is a production of the Pritzker Military Museum and Library. Bringing citizens and citizen soldiers together through the exploration of military history, topics, and current affairs. This is Pritzker Military Presents.
During their 15-month deployment to the Coringa Valley, the soldiers of Battle Company did not muse over matters of bureaucracy or strategy behind the U.S. presence in Afghanistan. Instead, they were consumed by the everyday anticipation of attacks and ambushes. The agonizing physical toll of battle in excruciating heat and of trying to make progress in a seemingly hopeless situation. Over the course of 5 visits to the Coringa Valley, author Sebastian Younger followed the men of Battle Company. His chronicle of their experiences helps us understand the intense bond that only brothers in arms can share, both during combat and in the days, months, and years that follow. This program is coming to you from the Pritzker Military Library in downtown Chicago. Later on, we'll be taking questions from our studio audience and from those of you joining us on the internet at PritzkerMilitaryLibrary.org. Sebastian Younger is a contributing editor to Vanity Fair and the New York Times, best-selling author of The Perfect Storm and A Death in Belmont. With the late Tim Hetherington, he directed the documentary Restrepo, which won the Grand Jury Prize at Sundance. He joins us today to discuss his book, War. Please join me in welcoming to the Pritzker Military Library, Sebastian Younger.
Thank you. Thank you for coming out today. It's a real pleasure and honor to be here. I'm going to talk about my experience in Afghanistan and a little bit about war in general. I've been covering wars since 1993 when I first went to Bosnia. I was a struggling freelancer, could not quite seem to assemble a career for myself. I wound up as a climber for tree companies in Boston, and I worked on a rope 80 feet in the air with a chainsaw, and I eventually hurt myself. I was always scared of falling. You know, I think we're instinctively adapted to fearing heights, but we're not adapted to fearing chainsaws. So, of course, I never fell. It was the saw that hurt me. I hit my leg. I was just about to turn 30, and I just thought, I got to figure out a plan for my writing career. So I went to Bosnia during the civil war there. I went on to many other wars in the world, Liberia, Sierra Leone, Kosovo, Afghanistan in 1996. Starting in 96. War is a terrible thing, but one of the things I learned in my experience reporting on it is that sometimes it's necessary. The civil wars that I covered were stopped, every single one was stopped by military action by Western forces, which I know is a very controversial thing. But from the perspective of someone on the ground, either a reporter like myself, or a civilian who's suffering the consequences of armed aggression by a government or by an enemy state. Sometimes the NATO planes overhead are dropping bombs are the only thing saving your life or an incredible relief. And so that is the fact that war is a terrible thing and sometimes we need to wage war to stop war is one of those horrible conundrums that is so complicated to sort out. And I think because it's such complicated territory, it makes makes for terrific political arguments in this country and in others. And let's face it, we have to argue about war. If we don't, we might enter into it too easily. That's the political level of war. But there's a very personal level to it as well, which is what I wanted to understand. When I went to Afghanistan in 07, 08, I was with Battle Company in the Korangal Valley of eastern Afghanistan. I wanted to understand what war feels like for soldiers. I mean, feels like, what the experience is like. The reaction to war that men have, and I'm going to say men in my talk because there was only men in the Korangal Valley. There are many women in uniform. They provide a vital role in our military, very courageous women, but none of them were in the Korangal. So I'm, for simplicity's sake, I'm going to refer to men out there. Their reaction to combat is very complicated, and they don't understand it, and we as a society don't really understand it. Here's an example. I read recently, a few years ago actually, a biography of Daniel Boone. And we all know the story, right? He led small bands of settlers over the Appalachian Mountains into Kentucky, into Ohio, into very hostile territory. They were attacked continually by the Indian tribes there. And I mean, just what could be more terrifying? I mean, you're with 20 or 30 other people in an isolated outpost behind a stockade. You can't call in air power if you get into trouble. You're really on your own out there. I can't imagine anything more terrifying. And the Indian wars of that era were absolutely bloody and horrifying to all involved and damaging to everyone involved. And yet, this biographer of Daniel Boone found a journal entry from a young woman who was part of this terrifying episode in American history. She said, about the Indian wars, she said, "The men and the dogs have a fine time. As always, it's the women who suffer." What an incredible thing to say. What is it? What is it she was identifying in the men around her that, in addition to the great cost being paid by them and their families for this conflict that they were in addition to the pain of that, they were also apparently finding it to be the most intense, maybe the most gratifying period of their lives? What is that reaction that warriors have to war? I think as a society, we're uncomfortable with that. War is sometimes necessary, but always horrible. And so our reaction should be, I did my duty. I don't want to have anything to do with it. Thank God it's over. That would be very simple. It would be great if that was the only reaction people had to war, but unfortunately it's not, and I think the other reactions need to be understood. A woman asked me in an event like this, a woman raised her hand and asked me, why do soldiers compartmentalize their experiences in war? It was a great question. It was a simple question. It was so simple that at first I couldn't answer it. And then I sort of realized what the answer was. I said, they compartmentalize it because we do. Society compartmentalizes war. And I think as a society, as a peace-loving society, we get very uncomfortable with the idea that the experience of combat, in addition to all the horrible stuff, actually could be, for the people engaged in it, both journalists and soldiers, could also be exciting, tremendously exciting, captivating. Soldiers who have been in combat often miss it. Why do they miss it? What is it they're missing? They often return over and over to it. There were soldiers in World War II who were wounded on the front lines and brought back to rear base hospitals to recover. And there were stories of them literally going AWOL, violating orders, crawling out of windows, slipping out of doors to get back to their frontline units faster than the military would allow them to. What is exactly is going on there? The two things that I think society has trouble with, understandably, has trouble with, is the excitement of war and the profound sorrow, the devastating sorrow of it all. I think it's easier to understand war in terms of pride and patriotism and duty. But the excitement and the sorrow are uncomfortable feelings. And the book, my book, War, is about that territory, basically, is why do many soldiers miss it? What is it that they found of value out there that we don't understand, that maybe they don't even quite understand? That's what I wanted to explain. I'm going to read a short section, if I may, that I think gets to the heart of both of those things, the excitement and the sorrow. Both of those things that we as a society don't quite understand and that may sit a little bit uncomfortably with us if we do understand it. I was in a I was in a Humvee that was blown up by a roadside bomb. I usually took helicopters into the Korangal and, you know, resupply flights. The road in there was absolutely terrifying. The soldiers who had been in a lot of combat were terrified of just driving that road. It dropped off. I mean, if you sat on the outside and you looked out the window of the Humvee, you couldn't get high enough and look down steeply enough to even see the edge of the road. And off the edge of the road was a 300-foot drop into a canyon. And the wheels were so close to the edge of the road that you couldn't even see it. It was absolutely terrifying. And, of course, you get ambushed as well. So we were hit. I was in the second Humvee with the company commander, Captain John Thing. And we just pulled into this draw. I had my camera running, right? I was shooting video out there. I wanted to make a movie, which eventually did make a movie called Restrepo. I had the camera running, and we were just pulling into this draw, and we went over an IED, and it blew up underneath the engine block instead of under us. We were spared harm, but it was a pretty terrifying experience because we thought the Humvee was on fire. We thought we were going to get attacked. We were attacked. It was a mess. For a few minutes, it was a mess. We eventually got out of it okay. And this is what I wrote in the wake of that. War is a lot of things, and it's useless to pretend that exciting isn't one of them. It's insanely exciting. The machinery of war and the sound it makes and the urgency of its use and the consequences of almost everything about it are the most exciting things anyone engaged in war will ever know. Soldiers discuss that fact with each other and eventually with their chaplains and their shrinks and maybe even their spouses, but the public will never hear about it. It's just not something that many people want acknowledged. War is supposed to feel bad because undeniably bad things happen in it. But for a 19-year-old at the working end of a 50 cal during a firefight that everyone comes out of okay, war is life multiplied by some number that no one has ever heard of. In some ways, 20 minutes of combat is more life than you could scrape together in a lifetime of doing something else. Combat isn't where you might die, though that does happen. It's where you find out whether you get to keep on living. Don't underestimate the power of that revelation. Don't underestimate the things young men will wager in order to play that game one more time. We eventually got back to the COP, the company headquarters, and although I'd been completely unafraid in the Humvee, I mean, really so unafraid that I was worried about myself, I thought maybe I'd been wounded. I mean, I don't think my heart rate went above 60. All of that came later. It was a delayed reaction that the soldiers talked about as well. I had a series of sort of an emotional roller coaster that evening. It was pretty extraordinary. I've been on some kind of high amplitude ride all day since the bomb went off, peaks where I can't sit still and valleys that make me want to catch the next resupply out of here. Not because I'm scared, but because I'm used to war being exciting, and suddenly it's not. Suddenly it seems weak and sad, a collective moral failure that has tricked me, tricked us all, into falling for the sheer drama of it. Young men in their terrible new roles with their terrible new machinery arrayed against equally strong young men on the other side of the valley, all dedicated to a kind of canceling out of each other until replacements arrive. Then it starts all over again. There's so much human energy involved, so much courage, so much honor, so much blood. You could easily go a year here without questioning whether any of this needs to be happening in the first place. Nothing could convince this many people to work this hard at something that wasn't necessary, right? You'd catch yourself thinking. The question of whether Afghanistan is necessary or not is a complicated one, and I'm happy to engage with it in questions. I was there in 1996. It was a absolute horror show for those people. The Civil War there was an absolute horror show. That era ended in 2001. Our tragedy, in some ways, was their good fortune, because international forces came in and stabilized their country. This is now the lowest level of civilian casualties, civilian death from war in Afghanistan in 30 years. But it's still it's a complicated calculation we're still making about whether to be there. I'm happy to try to address those issues if any of you are interested, but I'll continue with my experience there. The Korangal Valley is about 6 miles long. It's in the Hindu Kush Mountains in eastern Afghanistan. Beautiful, absolutely beautiful. Looks like Colorado. Huge timber on the upper slopes, and there was a big logging business there. Timber was kind of the opium crop of that area. It was very valuable, and so there were several sort of valley elders, leaders who controlled the timber rights to the area, and as a result were very, very wealthy, and as a result had access to men at arms. They completely controlled the local population. It was almost a kind of feudal system in the Korangal. Most of the people, very, very poor, very, very poor farmers, had almost no access to the outside world, and then these very, very powerful sort of village elders that controlled the timber, controlled the weapons. Some of them were Taliban, some weren't. It was extraordinarily violent. I didn't know what I was going into, and I don't think most of the guys in Battle Company did either. When I was there for a while, when I was there in the fall of 07, one-fifth of all of the combat in all of Afghanistan was happening inside those 6 miles in the Korangal. 150 men of Battle Company were absorbing a fifth of the combat for 70,000 NATO troops across the country. I spent most of my time at a small outpost called Restrepo. It was named after the platoon medic, Juan Sebastian Restrepo, a young man who was born in Colombia, country of Colombia, emigrated to this country, and died fighting for us at the bottom of a hill in Afghanistan. One night, two platoons walked up the hill just south of the company headquarters, the COP, with tools and weapons and supplies, and their plan was to take over a ridge that was being used by the enemy to shoot down into the COP. Plunging fire is very effective. They were using this ridge. They thought, we'll put an outpost up there. So they walked up there with their tools and started hacking away at the shelf rock. There was no sand up there to fill the sandbags with. They had to fill the sandbags up with chunks of rock that they picked out of the hillside. They worked all night. As soon as it got light, they were attacked. The enemy were furious that they were taking that piece of terrain away. And those guys were attacked 13 times just in that first day alone. They worked and fought continually for 24 hours in 100-degree heat, in body armor and helmet. They said the fighting was actually the best part, the easiest part, because they could lie down, drink some water, take a little break, and shoot back. The work physically was brutal. They did that for 24 hours, and they had, at the end of that, they had a small outpost. I got out there a few days later. There was no electricity. The men slept on the ground. There was no, and never would be, any running water. There was no way to bathe. They did roughly 1 month shifts up there, and because they couldn't bathe, they didn't change their clothes, and because they didn't change their clothes, they never really got out of their clothes. You just kind of lived in whatever you were wearing for the duration. There was no internet. There was no phone. There was no communication with the outside world. It was absolutely scorching in the summer. It was just iron cold in the winter, sub-zero. They built little plywood hooches to live in that sort of clung to the side of the slope. It looked, you know, from a distance, it looked like maybe like a miner's camp in the Sierras in the, you know, 1840s or something. Everything just crooked and hanging off of things and very, very rugged. It was sandbags and crates of ammo and MREs and pallets of water, and that was it. And none of the things that young men like in the world were up there. There were no women. There was no alcohol. There was no drugs. There was no television. There was no sports. There was a lot of tarantulas. There was a lot of scorpions. Occasionally, the guys who didn't mind tarantulas would throw them at the guys who did mind tarantulas. You know how it is. And I made the huge mistake of I've had a phobia. Now I'm telling the whole nation, right? I've had a phobia of spiders my entire life, right? And I made the huge mistake of telling them that. And you just some advice, if you all are ever with a platoon of infantry in a remote place, don't admit to your fears, because they will exploit them. Don't imagine they won't. Everyone up there was almost killed in one way or another. And I don't mean in a general sense, like, well, it's a war zone, of course, we could have died. I mean, in very specific ways. There were days where my first day up there, the outpost was attacked four times. I mean, that's four firefights. There are many, many units in the U.S. military that have four firefights in their entire deployment. I heard this statistic. I assume it's true. 3% of the units in the U.S. military account for 80% of the casualties. Units like 2nd Platoon Battle Company. Guys walking around with bullet holes in their uniforms from rounds that went through the fabric but didn't touch them. Lives were saved or lost because of a half a second, a half an inch. I was leaning against a HESCO barrier, like a huge sandbag. One sort of lazy, hot morning, just kind of spacing out, not much was going on. And I was startled by some dirt that flew into my face. And you have to understand, many of you do, I'm sure, that bullets go faster than sound. So if someone shoots at you from a distance, from 400 or 500 meters, the bullets go by you before the sound reaches you. And bullets, when they pass you, it's kind of subtle. I mean, there's a snapping sound in the air. The air just seems to, something weird is happening in the air, but it's kind of subtle, and it really, the first thing that goes through your mind when someone's shooting at you from a distance is often a question. Like, are we getting shot at? Like, it's sort of like, what is that? Are those bullets? Like, you get kind of halfway through that sentence. Well, that's exactly what happened to me. I got sprayed in the face with dirt. I got halfway through the sentence, what the hell was that? And then I heard the gunfire. It was the first round, one of the first rounds of the first burst of an hour-long firefight. And it must have impacted a few inches from my head. Later, I had a chance to digest the implications of that. What's the angle of deviation that saved my life? Was it a gust of wind? What threw that bullet off? You realize, if you're in enough combat, that it's all kind of random. It's just a kind of random math. And you might comfort yourself with the idea that you believe in God, or you're a good person, or you have a wife, wonderful wife and family waiting for you back home, or you have an amulet around your neck, or whatever, that those things might protect you, might change the odds, change the math a little bit in your favor. It doesn't. That is it's a heavy thing, at least it was for me, to think that your life, your continued existence, is determined by an arbitrary and ultimately uncaring universe. And you either did or didn't die, but it's a matter of total indifference to the larger world, the larger universe. That's what it felt like anyway, when I realized how close it had come. At any rate, after the firefight, I kind of wandered around the outpost, a little bug-eyed, a little wide-eyed. I'd just gotten up there. I'd only been up there a few days. And I tried to tell my story to the guys, and I really couldn't have picked a worse group of guys to try to impress with my little story, because they'd all been through it. And they're now wrestling with that sort of brutal fact of reality about dying, not dying, it's all arbitrary. They're wrestling with that at age 20. I'm in my 40s and it was upsetting. At 20, you're not even supposed to be thinking about dying, really, It was a very rough deployment for them. I did 5 1-month trips, so I wasn't out there the whole time. I always missed it when I left. I got really close to those guys. I worried about them when I was home. Thought about them constantly. Worried that something bad was going to happen while I wasn't there, even though I didn't carry a weapon. Obviously, it was not a damn thing I could have done to help, but still I worried. And then as the time would get close to go back out there, of course, I'd start getting anxious about it. I'd start dreading it. One of the things I became very interested in my project was fear. How does fear work? It's not an obvious thing. You can be wildly scared about something that's not that dangerous, and you can be completely blasé about something that's quite dangerous. What I found was that in combat, there was a weird absence of fear. It was just this sort of jacked up blur. And then it would happen later in dreams, in just bad moments, and the fear would happen beforehand also, dread. There are many kinds of fear. Dread for me is the worst kind of fear. It's just this sickness in your stomach about something that you're worried will happen. You're going out on a patrol in a few hours. It's a bad place. I went on every patrol. I slept where those guys slept. I lived identically to the soldiers, except I didn't carry a weapon. And in the hours before a patrol, I would just get this dread in my stomach. That was absolutely the worst. And as one of them said to me at one point, we were talking about this, and he said, you know, it's weird. Some of the scariest stuff out here didn't even happen. It's the stuff we were worried about happening. But once you've been in an IED, every time you get in a Humvee, you spend the entire time worried that it's going to happen again. And it doesn't have to for you to be traumatized by 3 hours of driving around braced for it. That's one of the weird things about fear. It doesn't have to be connected to an actual threat. After this long, rough deployment, the guys got back to Italy. They're based in Vicenza, Italy. And one of them, Brendan O'Byrne, he was the only guy who got out of the Army. And we had a lot of talks about how he was adjusting to civilian life. And at one point he said to me, we were just talking about the complexity of combat, and he said to me, you know, it was so strange. He said, there were guys in the platoon who straight up hate each other, but we'd all die for each other. What an extraordinary, extraordinary concept, right? He really struggled when he came home. He really sort of went into a nosedive. He had a lot of problems before he got in the Army, and the Army sorted him out in many, many good ways, by his account, made a man out of him. But he left the Army with the same, you know, with many of the same problems he came in with. And he really went through hell. And at one point, we stayed friends. He lived near New York, and so we saw each other a lot. I actually taught him how to do tree work, how to work as a climber. I loaned him my gear, and now he's got a great job climbing in the Boston area, in fact, with my old boss from 1990. Sort of amazing. I called up my old boss, Bobby Laurie, and I said, I trained this guy as a soldier how to climb. He's a great climber, and he's got a lot to learn, but he's brave, and he's fit, and he's ready to learn, and Bobby hired him. So that was sort of personally satisfying, immensely satisfying to see that sort of loop in my life. But at any rate, I invited Brendan to a dinner party to meet some of my friends, and this woman, 40 years old, a couple of kids, had read the manuscript of my book, it wasn't out yet, and asked Brendan, oh, it's so nice to meet you. I got a question for you. Is there anything at all you miss about being out there? And he said, ma'am, I miss almost all of it. What an amazing answer. I really thought, that's got to be explained. If we as a society don't understand what he misses and don't understand that what he misses might be actually a healthy thing in life, a healthy experience, if we don't understand that, we can't hope to provide not a duplicate of that, but something equivalent that meets those same needs here in society. Brendan will never have a psychologically, emotionally speaking, a home in this society if he can't, in a healthy civilian way, duplicate the good experiences he had out there. We have to understand it to even begin making a place for that for him with us. What was he talking about? First of all, I think the conventional explanation is adrenaline, right? They've been exposed to combat. They're adrenaline junkies. They're addicted to combat. they've sort of been ruined for any normal life because they've basically taken this drug and now they're hooked on it. Basically, the response is pathologized. And in pathologizing it, you delegitimize it. I think there's a certain amount of that. We all know that statistically, young men are tremendous risk takers. The statistics bear it out. The death rate for young men from accidents and violence is astronomical compared to young women and compared to older men. We all know it. You know, you read it in the papers every day. Guys drive too fast, they get into fights, they drink too much, they jump off of things they shouldn't jump off of, they swim across things they shouldn't swim across, they light things on fire that eventually explode. Whatever it is, they do stupid stuff, and the result is that they are literally, literally safer within the strictures of the fire department, the police department, and probably most of the units in the U.S. military. They are safer in those environments operating under the strictures of those jobs than they are just walking around at 19 years old thinking up dangerous things to do. Statistically, they're far better off. So there, obviously there is an adrenaline component. But I think there's something more profound going on as well. The thing they can't get here that they have out there is brotherhood. And brotherhood's different from friendship. Friendship is a function of how you feel about a person, and it's a powerful thing. It's a beautiful thing, and it exists in combat as well. But it's not brotherhood. Brotherhood has nothing to do with how you feel about another person. So it's different from friendship. Brotherhood is the understanding that each person in the brotherhood will place their personal interests, their welfare and safety below that of everyone else in the group. And if everyone does that, they're all safer. It's the understanding, and this was borne out many times in combat, it's the understanding that if you're behind, just to give you an example, if you're behind cover and one of your buddies is in danger, you have, as a soldier and as a human being, you have a choice. You can preserve your life and allow him to die, or you can risk your life and try to save him. And over and over and over again, soldiers choose overwhelmingly to do the latter. And I think that really what's going on is they're saying to themselves, I would rather die trying to save someone I love than survive and live in shame the rest of my life. An obvious choice for any parent with their kid. What parent wouldn't risk or sacrifice their life to save their kid? Well, that's what happens with soldiers. Now, you take a guy, someone who's in a unit like that with this clear sense of purpose, like what their job is, what's expected of them by others, the security that you're with 20, 30 guys who will die for you if they need to, will literally throw themselves on a hand grenade. I mean, not every soldier is that honorable and noble, but the vast majority in those circumstances act with unbelievable courage, bordering on self-sacrifice. The phrase, throw yourself on a hand grenade, it's not just a phrase, it's not just a figure of speech, it happens, it literally happens. Guys will throw themselves on a hand grenade because they, in that split second, they would rather die than allow three or four of their buddies to die. It's incredible. Well, the security of that bond is overwhelming. So you take that guy and you put him back in society, and all of a sudden, he doesn't have the safety of that. He doesn't know what he's supposed to do. He doesn't have a role like he did in the squad. In combat, you're completely self-defining. I mean, the core value out there is, are you a good soldier? And I don't mean in terms of what the lieutenant colonel thinks. Are you a good soldier in terms of what your buddies think? Because their lives depend on you being a good soldier. A good soldier means you clean your weapon, you hydrate before long patrols, the million tiny details that can save people or kill people in combat. And will you risk your life for me? And if you live up to that standard, you have all the respect, all the love and admiration from your peers you could ever want. And everyone can choose to be courageous. It's not something you can buy. You're not born brave. You don't have to be tall. Someone who's 4'8" can be just as brave as someone who's 6'5". There is nothing you're given at birth or during life that allows you to be brave any more than any other person. It's completely a matter of free will, a matter of personal choice. In that sense, it's just completely democratic. Back home, you all remember being 19, 20. You're judged for all these things you have no control over. You're not self-defining, right? Are you good-looking or not? Are your dad wealthy or not? You know, is your dad in prison or not? You know, whatever. I mean, all these things, you have no... I mean, that's why being a teenager is so anguishing sometimes, because you're being defined by others for things you have no control over. It's horrible. In combat, that's not true. You can be ugly, you can be good-looking, you can be gay, you can be straight, you can be rich, you can be poor. If you're a good soldier out there at a place like Restrepo, none of that matters. All those civilian identities do not matter. For that matter, as a journalist going in there, civilian, right? Initially the guys heard I was working for Vanity Fair. Tim and I were working for Vanity Fair. They heard that, the boys heard that two Vanity Fair reporters were going out there for some reason, right? And they were psyched. They were absolutely delighted until we showed up and they realized we were guys. They expected two women. So after we got over that little hurdle, now's the question of, okay, well, how are you going to act out here? Are you going to be a problem? Tim and I, again, our civilian identities were more or less squashed because of the demands of the environment. We became soldiers not in the sense that we carried guns, but in the sense that we did exactly what people told us we should do. We made sure to hydrate before patrols, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We did all of those things, and we fit in. Let me see how much time I got. Let me just take 2 minutes here, and I'll open it for questions. My colleague Tim Hetherington was killed in combat in Libya 2 months ago. He was incredibly brave. I saw him do just extraordinary things out at Restrepo. He was in Misrata. A single mortar shell came in, killed and wounded a group of journalists. Chris Hondros was killed. American photographer was killed instantly. Tim was hit in the groin, and he bled out in the back of a pickup truck while a Spanish photographer named Guillermo, who I had the honor of meeting, wonderful guy, held his hand, trying to keep him awake long enough to get to the hospital, and he bled out. His hand just got cold. And it was a terrific shock for me. It was the first person, close person that I've lost in combat or otherwise, and it was shocking how painful that was. And I got an email from that day, the first day that I got the phone call about Tim. I got an email from a Vietnam vet who Tim and I had met in Texas. And he really liked our film, and he really liked our books. He really thought we had sort of captured it, right? So he sent me this email after Tim was killed. And he said, "Sebastian, I'm so sorry about your loss, but I have to tell you something. I hope it doesn't sound too callous." He said, you and Tim, with your movie and your books, you got pretty close to understanding what combat is about, what war is about. You got really close, but you did not get all the way. He said, "The central truth about war, the core reality of war, is not that you might die out there. I mean, you might, but that's not the core reality of it. The core reality of it is that you absolutely will, guaranteed, lose your brothers. That's for sure. Whether you die or not, who knows? But you will lose your brothers." And he said, "Until today, you really didn't know the first thing about war. And now you know everything you need to know about it." He was absolutely right. And one reaction, at least at age 49, having done this for almost 20 years, one reaction to completely understanding war is to want to get as far away from it as possible. And that's been my reaction. Maybe 10 years ago it wouldn't have been, but that's my reaction now. I'm going to try to continue covering these important stories, but not from the backs of pickup trucks getting shot at, from some other vantage point that allows me access to that story from an angle that I've never had before. So I'd like to open it to questions, but it's been a tremendous pleasure talking to you. Thank you. Thank you very much.
have some questions from the balcony, Sebastian. First is, did you ever think that you would join the military? And second, what do you think will happen when the U.S. draws down forces in Afghanistan?
You know, I did not think I would join the military. I mean, I came of age in the wake of Vietnam, and the military, the nation was pretty ambivalent about the U.S. military in those days, and I didn't understand it. You know, I didn't know any soldiers. It was the 1980s. You know, I mean, it's a terrible thing to say, but a peacetime military, I mean, just going back to what the Daniel Boone story, a peacetime military in some ways is not that much of a draw for the young men who want to test themselves in combat, which I think is often why young men join. I mean, there's a lot of rhetoric about, well, they join out of patriotism or 9/11, all those things were true. I mean, you could hear them say that out at Restrepo, but underneath that reality, there was a deeper reality of a test of manhood, and they all talked about it in one form or another. So a peacetime army is not that alluring to someone who has that impulse. In some ways, the way that I tested myself as a person was tree work. Tree work was scary. In addition to being scared of tarantulas, I'm scared of heights, you know? And that was sort of my personal test. And it was interesting, once I learned how to disengage from my fear in the top of a tree, I mean, there's nothing scary than being 80 feet up in a tree, right, with a running chainsaw, topping out the last 20 feet, hoping it falls right, falls that way rather than back on you. There's nothing scarier than that moment. And you have to disengage from that fear and become a momentary fatalist in order to make the second cut, the back cut. You do the front cut, and then you start on the back cut. When you start that back cut, you're setting in motion a process you cannot stop that either will or won't kill you, hurt you. And you need to be a bit of a fatalist to start that back cut. And that disengagement from fear I learned in trees, and it was really useful out in the Korangal. It's a trick, you know. It's a trick that all of us have access to. And the drawdown, okay, I mean, I'll try to make an incredibly complicated thing short and simple. If we stay too long, we become occupiers, which is bad for us and bad for them. If we withdraw too quickly, the country implodes again like it did in the 1990s. The casualty rate will skyrocket. 30,000 Afghan civilians have died in the decade since NATO has been in Afghanistan, roughly 30,000, something like that, two-thirds of them killed by the Taliban. If we withdraw too quickly, it goes back to civil war, and it will go back up to the level of the 1990s, something like 400,000 Afghan civilians died in the 1990s. That's the era we put a stop to. We don't want, that's bad for them and bad for us as well. So I think what has to happen, the tactical problems have kind of been figured out, I think. The surge worked. It really degraded the Taliban's capability, at least for the time being. Most of those guys who were sent in were Marines. The Marines are an assault force. They're not an occupying force. I think they probably have to be shifted out of there again. Otherwise, it really is not in keeping with their training and their role. But I think that's fine because the problems ultimately are political. It's not a military problem so much anymore. We needed those platforms in order to kill bin Laden. Don't make any mistake about it. If we were not in Afghanistan, we would not have been able to kill bin Laden, like end of sentence. You can't fly SEAL Team 6 from Virginia. You can't get the intelligence that we needed from Virginia. But now I think it's really a political problem. The Afghan government is just completely corrupt, self-serving criminal syndicate, basically. And there's many, many good people in the government itself, but the government as a whole is completely rotten, and the people know it. And the Afghans, they can fight like devils, right? I mean, they drove the Soviets out. Believe me, they can drive the Taliban out if they want, if they have something worth fighting for. And if I think what we need to do is twist Karzai. We have never, President Bush nor President Obama, really put the screws to President Karzai about corruption, and the Afghans know it. And until those changes are made, we will have to defend that government because the Afghans, why would you? Why would you defend? Would you die for Hamid Karzai? No. Well, we wouldn't. Well, they won't either. And so I think we have to start with turning off the faucet of aid money that's pouring in there. Fuels a lot of corruption. That will cause pain. That can force changes, real changes in the corruption efforts. And ultimately, we can threaten to leave, because if we leave, Karzai's dead. And he knows it. I do not think he would call our bluff. I think we can demand, you know, this, and this anti-corruption program be really implemented. And if you don't do it, Hamid, we're out of here next year, every last soldier. And I think he would have to finally cooperate.
You said you were unarmed. Why are you unarmed? I mean, the Taliban don't care if you're unarmed, right?
I'm unarmed because I haven't been trained to fight by the U.S. military. There's nothing more dangerous than an armed and untrained civilian. And I'm a journalist. I mean, I report on the story. And you can't report on a story that you're taking part in. That becomes a soldier's story, and I'm a journalist. And I would lose all credibility as a journalist. I mean, credibility in the sense that I would not be able to pretend to comment objectively about the issues surrounding this war if I were a participant in the war. My role as a journalist is something that I value above virtually everything else in my life. And if there was a situation out there where doing something, picking up a weapon became a matter of survival for me or for someone else, I would do it in a second. But fortunately, it never came down to that. Chosen Company, a few valleys north of us, they had some horrific firefights. In one, they sent out a 28-man patrol to a village called Aranas. On the way back, they were ambushed, and in some number of minutes, every guy in that patrol had a bullet in them. They had 100% casualties in a few minutes. The wounded fought off the enemy. Had Tim and I been with Chosen Company on that patrol, we would have been doing something for sure. And so we actually asked the medic to train us in battlefield medicine and give us med packs so that, you know, if we were in a catastrophic attack and I needed to help him or there were a soldier wounded or whatever, like that we would have the knowledge to at least begin doing that. I didn't want to sit there helplessly while someone died. And likewise, I asked to be shown how all the weapons worked. They're not complicated. A machine gun is not a complicated thing. I mean, 5 minutes, someone can show you everything you need to know. I never had to resort to that, thank God.
Hello, sir.
Hi.
I'm taking in those noble words posted behind you. And I must say they stand in stark contrast to the staged rescue of PFC Jessica Lynch, the outright deception involved in the cover-up of Pat Tillman's death, and considering that a crippled racehorse in this country gets better care than a wounded combat veteran, do you see anything shamefully pretentious in our political and government leaders in their stated commitment and appreciation for the sacrifices being made?
Well, that's a complicated question. I guess I would say that politics has always been, at least to some degree, a matter of deception and saying what people want to hear. And I know in times of war, every country I've ever been in, Bosnia, Sierra Leone, Liberia, long list, there is an enormous amount of rhetoric about national identity that doesn't reflect the complexity of the real world. There are dishonorable stories that come out of every war. All governments deceive to some degree. And there are stories of incredible heroism that come out. And does it surprise me that the leaders of this country occasionally pick the good stories and ignore the bad stories? No, it doesn't surprise me. I think every government does it. And so I guess what I would say to you is that's human affairs. Like as humans, we have the capacity for tremendous nobility, but we're also very complex and contradictory, and you're always going to get this weird bipolar tug of war between our greatest instincts and our worst instincts, and they come out in war like everything else.
When you were with Battle Company in 07 and 08, Did you know who you were fighting? Were they locals? Were they Pashtuns from Pakistan? Were they foreign fighters? And what was their degree of training? I mean, did they look like they knew what they were doing from a training standpoint?
Out in the Korangal, they were fighting all of the above. I mean, literally the whole laundry list. I mean, at the bottom were local guys. It was a Pashtun area. There were local guys, teenagers who were paid, $5 a day, given an AK and some magazines and told to climb up that ridge and just shoot at the Americans. And they were not well trained, and they they'd get killed. On up from them were sort of the hired guns that, run by the timber barons out there. The whole timber thing is complicated. I won't get into it. But there were some mistakes made by the Karzai government about restricting the sale of timber, and that sort of forced these timber crews into warfare. It was very complicated. But and then, keep going on. And there were, Pakistani fighters trained in the madrasas that came over from Bajor province, 20 miles away across the border. And, we'd hear the radio communications on the field radios and the Taliban, we got 20 guys coming in from Pakistan. They got ammo, they got this, they got that. And often they get sent through the Korangal. I mean, the Korangal was a guaranteed firefight for everybody, right? If you were in the U.S. military and you wanted your CIB, just get to the Korangal. If you were a journalist and you wanted to get your ticket punched, I'm a certified war correspondent now because I've been in a firefight, go to the Korangal. Guaranteed in a week, you got it. But likewise for the Taliban. I heard that they would send their new guys that just been trained up, they'd send them through the Korangal, they'd spend a week there. The guys that survived would move on and fight in other areas because now they'd been exposed to combat. It was a shooting gallery that everyone exploited to some degree. There was also other logic to our presence there and the Taliban presence there, but that was one of the things that was happening. And then, on up, there was there were foreign fighters that would come through, and those guys were really well trained. I mean, if you take away the air power that the U.S. had access to just on the ground, I mean, the guys in second platoon that I talked to about it were like, those guys tactically are equal. Many of them had night vision, they had ammo racks, they had, fleece jackets, from EMS, whatever. They really, they were very, very well trained. And those guys were scary and very, very courageous. Recently in December, last December, a guy named Abu Ikhlas was picked up in the area of the Korangal. He was an Arab who'd been in the area since the 1980s, fought the Soviets, married a local woman. He was the top Al-Qaeda guy for Kunar. And Kunar is an incredibly important province. I mean, it was always been the sort of center of armed resistance in previous wars. It's mountainous, it's remote, has a lot of advantages. So he was extremely important, Abu Ikhlas. They finally picked him up in December. They kept it secret. They announced it in April. And a couple of weeks later, they got bin Laden. And I was told, I haven't confirmed this, I do not know if it's true, but I was told by someone in the military that he thinks that part of the information stream that led to bin Laden came out of the capture of Abu Ikhlas. So yeah, from top to bottom, local guys right on up to guys like that, it was everything.
I have two questions. Do the soldiers, other than knowing that they're working with their brothers, do they understand what the mission is and why they're there from a political point? Do they know why they're there? And then as you were just talking, kind of a follow-up to the question you were talking about, who is funding the enemy? Where is the enemy getting their money to provide the equipment that they have?
I don't know that much about the source of funding. I mean, there are Arab donations that flow in there. There was timber money, timber that was smuggled out in violation of the law. I know at one point the wheat harvest, the spring that we were there, the wheat harvest was really bad, and so there wasn't much money to buy ammo with, and so there was less fighting because it wasn't a good wheat crop. And so it was even tied in locally to the local economy. I mean, not that all the locals were Taliban, but, The big guys in the valley, I think, implemented a kind of tax on the locals for what they grew, and part of that tax went into the Taliban because some of those guys were Taliban. So, I'm sorry, what was the other part of your question?
The second part was, do the soldiers
understand their mission? The soldiers understand their mission in a very, like, tunnel vision sense, which is as it should be. I mean, they don't have to agree or disagree with whether we're in Afghanistan or whether the COIN strategy, counterinsurgency strategy, is a good one or does it need to be tweaked. Like, they're there to do a job. It's very much like the police. It's exactly like the police. Like, the police do not debate the broader socioeconomic realities that affect the crime rate. They're walking down the street trying to prevent crime and trying not to get killed. That's soldiers. There are guys in the Army that deal with the broader mission, the strategy, but that's not the a guy with an M4 at an outpost, and nor should it be. Those are older people who, I mean, Colonel Bill Ostlund, who was the battalion commander, I mean, in my opinion, a just brilliant guy. I really liked him. And I mean, he literally knew more about Afghan history and our strategy there. He knew more about the Afghan culture than most of the press that went through. I mean, he was an enlisted man. He got out, went to the Tufts School, what's it called? Fletcher School of Diplomacy, right? Fletcher School of Diplomacy at Tufts. And his thesis was on the Soviet experience in Kunar province. That was his graduate thesis. That guy was smart, right? So there's guys like that, and then there's guys like I was with who were not thinking about that. They're 20 years old. They're not, in some ways, not supposed to be.
We're going to take two from the balcony, I think, we have up here.
You kind of framed a problem that I was hoping you'd address, and that is the corruption that seems to be the ongoing or forward-going nexus of how to understand this. But we've been hearing from the press a couple of things, and one of them is that we spent these tens of billions of dollars for what, in terms of how are we going to get this country in any semblance of manageability or progress or whatever. And the other thing is, I lost my
train. Want me to start in on that?
Yes. Thank you. Sorry.
That's all right. Well, I'll answer for what. I mean, it's not hard to answer. We haven't crossed the finish line, obviously, but we all know the bad things that are happening in Afghanistan because it's really bad things that make headlines more than good things. I don't know why. They're more dramatic. I mean, that's a weird thing about press coverage, is like all the journalists wanted to go, after Tim and I were in the Korangal, got a lot of coverage, 80% of the press that embedded with the U.S. forces in Afghanistan would ask the public affairs office to go to the Korangal Valley, 80% of them, right? So what do you get what do you get as a picture of Afghanistan? You get combat. And, you know, most of Afghanistan is not in the throes of combat, but nobody goes there because there's no story there. I mean, that's one of the sort of, like, ironies of news reporting. Tim and I could have been in the Panjshir Valley north of Kabul. You know, they haven't fired a shot there in 10 years. And, you know, you would have a totally different view of the war in Afghanistan. You'd think we should leave because it's over. That's the problem. The press is very sort of, it's very selective. But, okay, just to run a few statistics. I mean, the lowest level of civilian casualties in that country in 30 years, 1.5 million under the Soviets, 400,000 in the 90s, you know, 30,000 in this decade. And such a huge proportion of the civilian casualties are from the Taliban that human rights groups, Afghan human rights groups in Kabul, are asking for human rights investigations into Taliban commanders for abuses because they don't want those guys being part of any negotiated solution. Something like 80% of casualties are now caused by the Taliban, right? So a sevenfold increase in children's access and attendance in schools. There's no ending war until children are educated. I mean, seriously, it's the next generation that really we have to look at. A third of those children are girls. It's amazing. And they've shown real links between education of girls and economic prosperity and political stability in countries. Like, that is the crucial link. You don't educate the girls, you have Afghanistan generation after generation. So that's pretty amazing. It's the highest rate of economic growth of any country in that region right now, in Afghanistan. I mean, there are many, many good things. It's just the only problem is that if we left, it would all collapse because the Taliban would take over. So how do we leave? How do we leave without that happening? Again, by giving the Afghans a government that they think is worth fighting and dying for so that we don't have to. How do we do that? We start turning up the pressure on Karzai in a way that we never have before. I don't know why. It's taken us 10 years. You start turning off the tap on the billions of dollars of foreign aid, much of which is going into their pockets. You start turning the tap on that until they reform. And if that doesn't work, in my opinion, you say, all right, it's your problem. We're leaving. Unless you do this, 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 and this, very concrete steps towards ending corruption, you make that declaration loudly, publicly, so the Afghan people hear it. Unless you do these things, we're leaving on that date. And I really think Karzai would blink first, because if we follow through on that threat, it's a disaster for a lot of people, but it'll be a disaster for him as well. I don't think he will allow that to happen.
I have one more question in the balcony.
It occurred to me as I was listening to the beginning of your presentation, as you were talking about the difficulties that soldiers have integrating back into civilian life, that you have some insights into some of the jobs that they might gravitate towards based on the book that you wrote, The Perfect Storm. And I was wondering if, as you were writing this book, you had any thoughts about the similarities between what drives people into combat and also drives them into civilian jobs like swordfish.
I mean, sometimes it's economic necessity. I should say that with the military, if you just need a job, you can get a job with the military changing the oil on Humvees at a rear base, not get shot at. I mean, you know, like, you can do that. The guys that I was with, they may or may not have needed a job. I don't know. But all of them wanted to be in combat. Like a combat unit, you know, if you're in battle company, the 173rd, you really wanted to be in that unit. Like, you have to go through a lot to get in there. And they were very, very proud of that. And I think there is a way to take whatever that is, whatever, I don't even know how to describe it, whatever that impulse is to test yourself, to run some kind of risk, to be in a tightly bonded group, whatever that impulse is in those young men, I think there is some way to channel it in civilian society that's productive and feels gratifying for them. They probably make great firemen. I think they'd make great fishermen. You know, I mean, I've told them that, and Brendan at least, that's what he's doing. He's doing tree work for the moment. So,
Sebastian, we've come to the end of our time. I guess we have to stay on track for the film today. But I know I'm speaking for everyone here in the room and everyone associated with the library. We feel terribly about your personal loss with Tim. But what you shared with us today and your honesty and your extraordinary reporting, thank you.
Sebastian. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Our thanks to Sebastian Younger for joining us. The book is War, published by 12. You can learn more about the library, download the audio podcast, and view other archive programs by visiting us at PritzkerMilitaryLibrary.org. For all the staff at the Pritzker Military Library in Chicago, I'm Ed Tracy. Thanks for joining us. Thanks. Thank you.
The views and opinions expressed in this program are not necessarily those of the library. This program is made possible by our sponsors. Series sponsors, Albert and Audrey Ratner, Karen L. Pritzker and Michael K. Block, Robert and Myrie Pritzker. Additional program support provided by the Chicago Sun-Times. If you would like to be a member of our studio audience or learn more about the library, visit us at PritzkerMilitaryLibrary.org.
The preceding program was produced by the Pritzker Military Museum and Library.